and it came about according to Jacob's instructions. Tamar received, dark-browed, her father-in-law's verdict, looking deep into his eyes, but she yielded. As a widow and a woman who mourns, she remained in her father's house, and nothing was heard of her 1 year and 2 years and even a third. After 2, she would have been justified in renewing her claim, but she expressly waited a 3rd year in order not to be told that Shelah was still too young. The patience of this woman was as remarkable as her resolution. Indeed, resolution and patience are probably the same thing. But now that Shelah was 19, and in the bloom of whatever manhood he would ever rejoice in, she came before Judah and spoke. "The term is up, and the time is now ripe for thee to give me to thy son as wife, and him to me as husband, that he raise up to his brother name and seed. Remember thy bond." Now Judah, even before the 1st year of waiting was out, had become a widower. Shua's daughter had died, out of affliction over his bondage to Astarte, the loss of her sons, and the blame on her head for their loss. He had now only Shelah left, and was less than ever minded to send him on the perilous journey. So he answered, "Bond? There was never one made, my friend. Do I mean by that I do not stand by the simple word of my mouth? Not so. But I would not have thought thou wouldst insist after so long a time, for it was a word of delay. Wilt thou have another such? If so, I will give it thee. But it should not be needed, for thou shouldst already have consoled thyself. True, Shelah is older, but only a little, and thou art further forward of him than when my word consoled thee. Thou mightest almost be his mother." "Oh, might I?" asked she. "Thou showest me my place, I see." "Thy place," said he, "in my opinion, is in thy father's house, to remain there a widow and a woman who wears mourning for 2 husbands. She bowed and went hence. Now comes the sequel. This woman was not so easy to put off the track and remove from the line of descent. The more we observe her, the more we are amazed. She had dealt very freely with her position in time, moving it down with her to the grandchildren, whom she cursed because they were in the way of those whom she would bring forward. Now she resolved to change generations a 2nd time and climb up again. She would pass over the 1 remaining member of the generation of grandchildren, whom they would not give her, that he might either die or else bring her and her womb into the line of descent. She would do this, for her flame might not be quenched, nor would she suffer them to shut her out of her God-inheritance. The sheep shearing. Now, these following are the things which happened to Judah, Jacob's son. Not many days after the day when the lion again played lioness and put himself before his cub, the sheep-shearing came round, and the feast of the wool harvest, and the shepherds and herders of the region gathered to eat and drink and offer sacrifice. The feast was held in different places. This time it was in the mountains, called Timnath, and hither came the shepherds and owners of the flock down from above and up from below to shear their sheep and have a good time. Judah went up together with Hira of Adullam, his friend and head shepherd, the same through whom he had got to know Shua's daughter, for they too meant to shear and have a good time. At least Hira did, for Judah was not inclined for a good time. He never was. He lived in hell, in punishment for a former share in evil doings, and the way his sons had lost their lives looked very like this hell. He was afflicted over his election, and on account of it would rather have had no feast and no good time. For if one is bond-slave to hell, all gaiety takes on the nature of the hellish and leads to nothing save befouling the election. But what was the use? Only the ill in body are excused from life. If one ails only in spirit, that does not count. No one understands it, and one must play one's part in life and keep the seasons with the rest. So Judah stopped 3 days at the shearing at Timnath, sacrificed, and feasted. The way back to his own place he traveled alone. He liked it better alone. We know that he went on foot, for he had a good knobbed staff of some value, a walking staff, not a cudgel for a beast, With it he strode down the hilly paths between vineyards and villages in the parting gleams of the day, which went redly to its rest. The roads and bypaths were familiar. There was Enam, the place Enaim at the foot of the heights, which he must pass on his way towards Adullam and the village of his kinfolk. The gate, the mud walls, the very houses, shone crimson in the glory of the exulting heavens. By the gate crouched a figure. When he came closer, he saw that it was wrapped in a katonet paspasim, the shrouding garment of those who are temptresses. His first thought was, I am alone. His second, I will go by. The third, to hell with her. Must the Kadesha, the daughter of joy, sit on my peaceful homeward way? So it looks to me, but I will take no heed, for I am twofold, that I am, he of whom it looks lively, and he who is bitter, denies himself, and goes angrily by. The old song, must it be sung forever? So sing the chained galley-slaves from their groaning hearts at the oar. Up above, I groaned and sang it with a dancing girl, and should be sated for a while. As though hell were ever sated. Shameful craving and absurd for the hundredfold hateful. What will she say? How behave? He who comes after me may try. I will go past. And he stopped. Greeting to the mistress. May she strengthen thee, she whispered. The angel of desire had already seized upon him, and her whisper made him shiver with lustful curiosity after this woman. Whispering wayside one, said he with trembling lips, for whom dost thou wait? I wait, she replied, on a lusty lustling who will share with me the mystery of the goddess. Then am I half the right man, said he, for a lustling am I, if not a lusty one. I have no lust to lust, yet she to me. In thy calling, methinks, one is not very lusty for lust either, but must be glad if others feel it. We are givers, she said, but if the right one comes, we know how to receive as well. Hast thou lust to me? He put his hand upon her. But what wilt thou give me? She stopped him. He laughed. In sign, he said, that I am a son of lust with some trace of lustiness, I will give thee a he-goat from the flock that thou remember me. But thou hast it not by thee. I will send it thee. A man says that beforehand. Afterwards he is a different man, and remembers not his former word. I must have a pledge. Name it. Give me thy signet from thy finger, and thy bracelets, and thy staff that is in thy hands. Thou knowest how to look out for the mistress, he said. Take them. And he sang the song with her by the wayside in the red evening glow. And she went away round the wall. But he went on home, and next morning he said to Hira, his shepherd, Well, so-and-so, you know how things are. At the gate of Enaim, the place of Enam, there was a temple prostitute, and her eyes had something about them under the katonet. In short, why make so much of it between men? Be so good and take her the he-goat I promised, so I get back my things I had to leave her, ring, staff, and bracelets. Take her a fine big billy-goat. I won't be shabby with the shabby creature. Maybe she is sitting again by the gate. Or ask the people of the place. Hira picked out the goat, diabolically ugly and magnificent with ringed horns, cleft nose, and long beard, and took him to the gate by Enaim, where nobody was. The whore, he asked within, who sat outside by the road, where is she? You must know your whores. But they answered him, Here was and is no whore. We have none here. We are a decent little place. Look elsewhere for the she-goat, for thy he-goat, or stones will be flying. Hira told that to Judah, who shrugged his shoulders. If she cannot be found, then the fault is hers. We have offered to pay. Nobody can reproach us. Of course, I have lost my things. The staff had a crystal knob. Put the goat back to the herd. With that, he forgot it. But 3 months later, it became plain that Tamar was with child. It was a scandal such as the neighborhood had not seen for a long time. She had lived a widow in mourning garments in her parents' house, and now it came to light and could no longer be hid that she had carried on shamelessly in a manner worthy death. The men growled in their beards. The women screeched their scorn and curses, for Tamar had always been arrogant and behaved as though she were above them. The hue and cry soon came to Judah's ears. "Hast thou heard? Hast thou heard? Tamar, thy daughter-in-law, has so behaved that she cannot hide it longer. She is with child by whoredom." Judah went pale. His stag eyes stood out. His nostrils flickered. Sinners can be extremely sensitive to the sins of the world. Besides, he had bad blood towards the woman because she had consumed his two sons, and also because he had broken his promise about his third. "She is guilty of crime," said he. "Brazen be the sky above her head, and iron the earth beneath her. She should be burnt with fire. Long ago she was due to the stake, but now the sin is open. She has committed an abomination in Israel, and besmirched her mourning garment. They shall set her out before the door of her father's house, and burn her to ashes. Her blood be on her own head." With long strides he outpaced the informers, who flourished switches, and on the way were increased by other flourishers from the villages round, so that it was an eager crowd who came up before the widow's house in Judah's train, whistling and jeering. Inside, one could hear Tamar's parents sobbing and lamenting, but from herself, no sound. Then three men were told off to go in and produce the courtesan. They squared their shoulders and went in, stiff-armed, chins drawn in, fists ready to fetch out Tamar, first to be pilloried and then to be burnt. After a while they came out again, without Tamar, bearing certain things with them. One had a ring between two fingers, the others splayed out. The second held a staff out in front of him by the middle. The third had a purple cord dangling from his hand. They brought the things to Judah, standing there foremost, and said, "We were to say this to thee from Tamar, thy daughter-in-law. From the man whose pledges these are, I carry my pawn. Dost thou know them? Then hearken. I am not the woman to let herself be destroyed together with her son from the heir of God." Judah the lion looked at the things, while the crowd pressed round him and peered in his face. White as he had been all the time with anger, so slowly now he grew red as fire, up into the roots of his hair and even into his very eyes, and was dumb. And then a woman began to laugh, and then another, and then a man, and then several men and women, and at length the whole place rang with their laughter, going on and on. They bent over with laughing, and their mouths gaped up towards the sky, and they cried, "Judah, 'twas thou! Ho, ho, ho! Judah hath got his son and heir from his whore! Ha, ha, ho, ho!" And Leah's fourth, he spoke very low, standing there in the crowd, "She is more justified than I," and went with bowed head out of their midst. But when, 6 months later, Tamar's hour came, she gave birth to twins, and they became mighty men. Two sons she had destroyed out of Israel when she descended in time, and for them she gave back two others incomparably better when she climbed up again. The first come, Phares, was in particular a most doughty man, and in the seventh remove he begot one who was doughtiness itself, named Boaz, husband of a lovely one. They waxed great in Ephratah, and were praised in Bethlehem, for their grandson was Isaiah, the Bethlehemite, father of seven sons, and of a little one who kept the sheep, brown with beautiful eyes. He could play on the lute, and with the sling he brought the giant low. By then he had been secretly anointed king. All that lies far hence in the open future, and belongs to the great history, of which the history of Joseph is only an interlude. But into this history has been interpolated, and there forever remains, the story of the woman who would not at any price let herself be put aside, but with astounding tenacity wormed herself into a place in the line of descent. There she stands, tall and almost sinister, on the slope of her native hills. One hand on her body, the other shading her eyes, she looks out upon the fruitful plains, where the light breaks from towering clouds to radiate in waves of glory across the land.